What is evolution? Many people have the sort of idea that evolution started with Charles Darwin. It's not true, it's a very old idea. The ancient Greeks had a theory of evolution, with life evolving from pond scum. But for a very long time, evolution was a tiny minority worldview because it simply could not face a very simple question. And the question is, if you have something which is obviously designed, how can it have happened without a designer? And the most famous version of this argument is that if you find a watch, there is no way you can say this watch created itself. Everybody knows a watch had to have a designer. And the human body is composed of a vast number of extremely complex, well-designed organs, every single one of which, in fact, every single cell of which, is billions of times more complex than a watch. So this obviously needed a designer too. And that argument made evolution effectively a non-starter until Charles Darwin put forward a plausible mechanism. And he could say, but this is how it could have happened. And his mechanism was natural selection. He said that life probably began in some warm little pond when some chemicals just came together. But now, once you've got these things coming together to form a living organism, at every reproduction, there are some little changes. Some of those changes are good, some of them are bad. The bad changes die out, the good changes survive and reproduce. And then in the lot that survive and reproduce, there are changes, some good, some bad. So all the bad ones die out, the good ones add up. So eventually you get things moving to ever greater levels of complexity. And everybody said, ah, yes, wonderful. Now, why did people say, ah, yes, wonderful? Because they wanted to believe it. There were vast numbers of people who wanted to believe in evolution. There were people like Erasmus Darwin, for example, who were putting forward evolution, but they just didn't have a plausible mechanism. They wanted to believe it, but they didn't have a mechanism. Now, this mechanism put forward by Darwin meant that thousands of people could suddenly say, aha, this is how it could have happened. And in the 1930s, three very famous world-class biologists got together. There was Theodosius Dobzhansky, who came from Russia, Ernst Mayr, who came from Germany, and Julian Huxley, who came from England. They all got together in America to work on Darwin's theory, and they produced what is called the Neo-Darwinian theory of evolution, which was an overarching theory. Now, they put forward this idea, and to define it, Julian Huxley, one of those members, put forward this definition. Evolution in the extended sense can be defined as a directional, an essentially irreversible process occurring in time, which in its course gives rise to an increase of variety and an increasingly high level of organization in its products. Our present knowledge indeed forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of transformation. You see, this is a totally overarching worldview. This covers everything, the whole of reality. You see, the whole of reality is evolution. In the beginning, there was an explosion that just produced gas. Thousands of millions of tons of it. And that gas just came together to form stars. And in the stars, there were nuclear reactions that would produce heavy elements like oxygen and iron. And then some of those stars contracted and exploded in novas and supernovas and produced all the heavier elements. And then just by chance, some of those elements came together to form the Earth. And then just by chance, some of those atoms and molecules came together to form a living organism. Because everything gets better. There are always changes that take place. The bad ones die out, the good ones survive. And so eventually we get everything. So here we've got a theory which answers all the big questions, like, why is there something instead of nothing? Well, nothing exploded into gas and the gas just came together and made everything. What's the meaning of life? Oh, there isn't a meaning of life. Everything just came out of an explosion. It happened by chance. There's no meaning. Will I be called to account for what I've done? No, of course not. No. Life is just a series of chemical reactions, and when you die, it's just that the chemical reaction stops. That's it. Finish. Nothing. What happens after death? Nothing at all. So you've got answers, admittedly not very cheerful answers, to the big questions of life. And that's why Richard Dawkins was able to say, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Up to Darwin, thousands had wanted to be atheists, but they couldn't be intellectually fulfilled. They had no answers to the big philosophical questions. Now they have. But there were some problems to be seen in that overarching definition. For example, very soon it became clear that the naturalistic idea of the origin of the universe, particularly the Big Bang, has got enormous holes in it. It is actually, surely, the most ludicrous idea that has ever been put forward as science. Every single explosion that has ever been observed has destroyed order, structure, and information. And this supposed explosion, which nobody ever saw, produced all the order and structure and information in the entire universe. Every other explosion that's ever been observed needed something to go bang. Here we have nothing to go bang. So the whole idea going right back to the Big Bang, it's got too many questions. So the evolutionists suddenly realize they cannot support their side of the argument with this debate. In a debate with this weak thing. So it really is extremely weak. Even John Maddox, the editor of Nature, the top journal, he wrote an article down with the Big Bang in which he said, in all respects, save that of convenience, this view of the origin of the universe is thoroughly unsatisfactory. And Langmuir pointed out that the Big Bang theories fit all of Langmuir's rules for pathological science. Sick science. So you won't find an evolutionist today who is prepared to debate or support that original definition of Julian Huxley. And when Bertrand Russell, the famous atheist, had to debate against Huddleston, he knew he couldn't defend that definition, so they agreed on the definition: a continuous naturalistic mechanistic process by which all living things have arisen from a single source, a single living source, which itself arose by a similar process from a non-living, inanimate world. But there's a problem there, and it soon became clear that evolutionists could not defend this definition either, because for this non-living inanimate matter to organize itself, it's got to get a huge amount of organization. And the second law of thermodynamics, which is the best established law in the whole of science, says that's impossible. Now, Isaac Asimov, an atheist, wrote an article on the second law of thermodynamics. And he put that second law of thermodynamics in very easy terms. And that law says, as far as we know, all changes are in the direction of an increasing entropy. That means of increasing disorder, of increasing randomness, of running down. But evolution requires that things go up. The second law of thermodynamics says, left to themselves, things go from bad to worse. But evolution says things go from bad to good, and from good to a whole lot better. The best established law of science says that's not true. Things left to themselves go downhill. And if something isn't done about these things, it's going to collapse into a heap of ruins. The only way you can prevent that happening is for some determined, intelligent input to do something about it. Now, the evolutionists tried for a long time to get over this by saying, but the second law of thermodynamics only applies for closed systems. It doesn't apply to open systems. The Earth's an open system. There's sunlight coming in. So the second law doesn't apply. And in doing that, all they did was show themselves to be totally ignorant, lacking in knowledge of science, and eventually people have had to address that. Dr. John Ross, for example, pointed out the second law applies equally well to open systems. There is somehow the notion that the second law of thermodynamics fails for such systems. It is important to make sure that this error does not perpetuate itself. It's important because evolutionists have been making utter fools of themselves all the time they were claiming that it does not apply to open systems. So now you're faced with a problem pointed out by the famous physicist Arthur Eddington. He said, if your theory is found to be against the second law of thermodynamics, I can give you no hope. There is nothing for it but to collapse in the deepest humiliation. Well, has the theory of evolution collapsed in the deepest humiliation? I don't think so. It's still being taught in all the schools. It's still being taught in the universities. It's still being put forward on the television and the cinemas. It doesn't seem to have collapsed at all. What's happened? Well, they've just changed the definition. And now, if you confront a biologist, he will only be prepared to accept evolution defined like this. Evolution is a change in the gene pool of a population over time. Explanation: a gene is a hereditary unit that can be passed on unaltered for many generations. The gene pool is the set of all genes in a species or population. So that's not much of a big deal, is it? This doesn't answer any of the big questions of life. You can't be an intellectually fulfilled atheist on this definition. It doesn't explain where anything comes from. You even have to start with the genes and the whole population of a species before evolution starts. This can't answer any of the big philosophical questions. So why have they gone for a definition like this? Because change in the gene pool can be observed. There are changes in gene pools happening all the time, and they always follow the rules of the second law of thermodynamics. They are always going downhill. Always. But there is change in the gene pool. There's a change in the gene pool at every death. There's a change in the gene pool at every conception. There is a change in the gene pool every time radiation leads to some creature born with no hair, or no eyes, or deformed legs, or twisted arms, or all sorts of things that are a direct result of the second law of thermodynamics taking its inevitable toll. But they're quite happy for you to carry on believing this story. In the school textbooks, they'll still show you this story about evolution as Darwin put it forward. They're quite happy for you to believe that, but they know perfectly well they can't defend it. They can only defend evolution when the definition is just change in the gene pool. The neo-Darwinian theory of evolution, it is totally undefensible. And what about a definition? We got a definition from one of the original proponents, Julian Huxley. That definition is completely wiped out. There is no biologist who will now defend that definition. Well, the last man standing among that great triumvirate was Ernst Mayr. Julian Huxley died in the 1960s, so did Dobzhansky. Mayr died in the 1990s, and he put forward a definition. And he said, Darwinism is not a simple theory that is either true or false, but is rather a highly complex research program that is continuously being modified and improved. Is this what they tell the children in our schools? It's not a theory which is true or false. Hey, what is it? It's like Schrodinger's cat. It's somewhere in limbo. It's neither dead nor alive until you look at it, and then it's one or the other. But which? Now, this is one of the top experts. This is Ernst Mayr. It's neither true nor false, and it's constantly changing. Is this what they tell the children in the schools? Well, he's now dead, and one of the top evolutionists today is Francisco Ayala. He is a very authoritative man, and he wrote a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science in which he said the modern theory of evolution is an amalgam of well-established theories and working hypotheses. Well, he was asked, how many of these theories and working hypotheses are there? He didn't know. If you don't even know how many of these hypotheses and things there are in them, how do you know what the theory is? It has been called a smorgasbord. You've got all sorts of things that you can pick and choose from. And if you want to explain this, you say, well, this one, there's the explanation. And if you want to explain that, you say, well, let's take this one. And he doesn't even know how many of these hypotheses are in the smorgasbord. But if you can't even tell how many of these theories are in it, how do you know if any of it's true? That problem was faced by Colin Paterson when he spoke to a meeting at the American Museum of Natural History. He asked the question of this assembled experts. He said, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that is true. He waited a long time and nobody answered. He asked the same question at the Evolution and Morphology Seminar in the University of Chicago. He said that was a meeting of very prestigious evolutionists. And for a long time nobody said anything. Eventually one person piped up and said, I do know one thing. It should not be taught in high school. But it is being taught in high school, and it's being taught in South Africa way down into the junior school. Now, the story of evolution starts off in some warm little pond. Well, that's how Darwin had it. Nowadays it's an ocean of prebiotic soup, and just by chance, atoms and molecules are supposed to come together, and that was supposed to be proved by Stanley Miller and Harold Urey in their experiment, and that experiment was supposed to show how life could have started in early Earth conditions. Look at the conditions in the early Earth, and then see if you can get life from it. Well, they started off with the wrong starting conditions, because everybody knows the Earth has always had water. All the evidence is it has always had oxygen. He had a mixture of methane and ammonia and hydrogen and no water. It's a water vapor, entirely different to what is known to be the case. He used the wrong procedure. He said that electric sparks, lightning, things like that, forced the atoms and molecules to come together. But he put in a trap here. Because those sparks, that shock, is more effective at breaking down amino acids than building up. So he put in a trap so that as soon as they were formed, they were taken out of the way and couldn't be destroyed. That's not what would have happened. He got the wrong results. What he got was a tar. And he found one or two amino acids. Now, as soon as you find an amino acid in tar, the tar blocks off the ends. It cannot form a polymer. It cannot do anything. It is totally useless towards making proteins. He found traces, minute quantities of amino acids among these tars. And he only found two kinds of amino acids. Now, the whole point of amino acids is that you can make proteins out of amino acids. You need 20 different kinds. Now, other people have done this experiment. They've changed the starting conditions. You have different ratios of gases, different gases. And using different conditions, you can get other amino acids. In some of the experiments, you can even get 3 or maybe even 4. But in all the experiments you can do, if you put together all the amino acids you can get, I think you can get 15 and you need 20. And they're always racemic mixtures, left-handed, right-handed. Life can only use left-handed amino acids. And there's no way of sorting them out unless you happen to have a chemistry laboratory. So all they did was to prove to everybody concerned in the field, they simply proved that life could not have formed like this on Earth. And yet, you look at the textbooks, you look at the television, you get stories about an ocean of prebiotic soup. But he didn't use any water because he knows perfectly well if you put amino acids in water, they just fall apart. He couldn't use water because amino acids just fall apart and nothing could happen. So this whole story of an ocean of prebiotic soup, it was known to be a non-starter before it was ever put to the public. Why are you being told stories like this? The people actually involved realized immediately Urey and Miller's experiment showed life could never have evolved on Earth. It must have evolved somewhere else. So Francis Crick, one of the famous, very competent researchers, said life must have started on some far distant planet. Now once you've got it somewhere else, then you can think of any conditions you like. And nobody can measure or test or observe, so you're safe. So he had life starting on some far distant planet, and there he had evolution taking place, and eventually an advanced civilization comes up. They put their genetic material on a spaceship, not necessarily a rocket like this. After all, nobody ever saw it. You don't know what it looked like, but they sent off their genetic material to Earth. Well, that never became very popular, but what did become popular was the story of the RNA world, which has an Earth covered with clay, and on this clay, RNA just spontaneously generates and becomes life. Now, Gestland and Atkins, two of the world's top experts on the theory, in their book, The RNA World, said, it is assumed that a magic catalyst existed. Hey, wait a minute, a magic catalyst. Has anyone ever seen a magic catalyst? Has anyone done any measurements on magic catalysts? Is this science or is this speculation? Well, it's certainly not science. If you want to get to science, you've got to get to measurements. Observations, the acid test of mathematics. Now, I know there are a lot of people who are not at all comfortable with mathematics, so let's just revise a little bit about powers of 10. I'm going to take as an illustration 1 millimeter as my unit, and we're all familiar with 1 millimeter. 10 to the power 1 means 1 with 1 zero after it, which is 10. Again, we're familiar with that. 10 to the power 2 means 1 with 2 zeros after it. That's 100. Now, when we get to bigger numbers, it's not quite so familiar. How about the number of millimeters to the moon? It's about 10 to the power 11. Now you can see how big 10 to the power 11 is. The number of millimeters to the sun, 10 to the power 14. To the stars, if they are as far away as the astronomers believe, then a normal sort of average star, about 10 to the power 22 millimeters. And if you have a very powerful telescope, you can see the furthest galaxies that the astronomers believe are there. And if they are as far away as the astronomers believe, then light traveling at 300,000 kilometers a second takes thousands of millions of years to cover all that distance. And if it's true, then the distance is about 10 to the power 30 millimeters. All that number of millimeters to the furthest galaxy, it is an astronomically huge number. You cannot imagine number 30, 10 to the power 30. So we can see why Emil Borelli, who is one of the world's top probability experts, said odds beyond 1 in 10 to the power 50 have a zero probability of ever happening, and even that gives it the benefit of the doubt. It doesn't happen. Now, as soon as you look at evolution, you find there are problems in the maths. And long ago, a famous symposium was called in America, it's called the Wistar Symposium, and the first paper presented there was by Murray Eden, and he pointed out that if you had all the amino acids you wanted, the whole Earth completely covered with them, the chance of just getting them to come together to form a protein is 1 chance in 10 to the power 300. And 25. Now 10 to the 50 is zero. No probability at all. 10 to the 325 is so vastly less probable that you can say there's no chance at all. Now Fred Hoyle, one of the greatest scientists of the last century, an excellent mathematician, worked out what's the probability of just getting the essential enzymes that the simplest living organism has to have to exist at all. Just the essential enzymes. And he showed that the probability is 1 chance in 10 to the power 40,000. Now, this is written out longhand here, and you can see it. See, it takes 13 pages of zeros. And just as a comparison, up there at the top, you can see I've written out 10 to the power 80 longhand. It's 1 with 80 zeros. It takes 1 1/3 pages of zeros. Now, the significance of that is, it is believed that the number of atoms in the entire visible universe, in all the stars, in all the galaxies, in all the clusters of stars, the clouds of gas and dust, no more than 10 to the power 80 atoms. And the chance of producing just the essential amino acids, 1 in 10 to the 40,000. Now, Harold Moravitz is recognized worldwide as the most prestigious biological physicist. What he says, everybody accepts because he's the top authority. He showed that the probability of the simplest bacterium happening by chance is 1 chance in 10 to the power 100,000 million. Now, just to write that out longhand, if you can write pretty quickly, and if you're prepared to spend 12 hours every day of your life, it will take you about 620 years to write that out. It is a huge number. Now, the evolutionists know this. When you confront them, they say, oh yes, there's no probability of that. But, you see, evolution's been going on for a long time. And there are lots and lots of planets in the universe. Evolution can have been going on all over the place. So probabilities like that can be faced, can they? How much time is there? Well, when I first started confronting evolutionists with this, they'd say, oh, well, life has been evolving for 2 billion years. Then later they put it up to 4 billion years. Well, maybe it's longer than that. Well, the longest estimate of the age of the universe that you'll come across in the journals which is vastly greater than the truth, of course, is 20,000 million years. So let's give them a whole lot more time than that. Let's say 300,000 million years. Now, if we multiply by 365, we get days, by 24, we get hours, multiply by 60, we get minutes, multiply by 60, we get seconds, and we find we have all these seconds, which is, as near as makes no difference, 10 to the power 19 seconds. How does that compare to 10 to the power 100,000 million? Oh, but we don't know how fast evolution works. Well, let's suppose evolution can work as fast as a supercomputer, or faster, and we can have 1,000 million major evolutionary advances every second. 1,000 million advances every second. Then we could have had 10 to the power 28 nanoseconds in 300,000 years. How does that compare to 10 to the 1,000? Well, you see, there could have been evolution going on all over the universe. How many places? Oh, we don't know. Well, the absolute maximum is wherever there's one atom of matter. 10 to the power 80. That's the maximum number of places evolution could be going on. So the absolute maximum, if evolution is going on wherever there's one atom, it's happening every nanosecond for 300,000 million years, then we could have got through 10 to the power 108. How does that compare to 10 to the 100,000 million? What's the probability we have to face at every single step? For 300,000 million years, everywhere where there is an atom of matter, every nanosecond, what's the probability that has to be faced? It's this. Which is pretty close to the probability of somebody winning the national lottery every nanosecond for 300,000 million years for 10 to the 99,999,999,885, because the chance of winning the lottery is about 1 in 10 to the power 11. What does that mean as far as the probability of evolution goes? You can forget it. You can absolutely forget it. And yet, you look at From a Frog to a Prince, or Expelled, and you will find people like Richard Dawkins saying, well, at every step on the way, there was a probability something like tossing a coin and getting heads three times in a row. Is this the probability of getting heads three times in a row? No. They are not telling the truth. I gave a lecture in Chicago a few years ago, and afterwards I sat to have dinner with a lecturer from one of the universities in Illinois. And I said to him, well, he was very disapproving of what I'd said. He said, And I said, well, look, you evolutionists, you know perfectly well that much of what you're saying is not true. Why don't you stand up and point out these things are not true and tell the truth instead? And he gave this amazing answer. He said, we cannot tell the public the truth about evolution. They would not understand and would be confused. Question, if they're not telling us the truth about evolution, that means they're telling us lies about evolution. Lies like this. Lies like this. This. These two things, they're in the school children's textbooks. This, the evolution of the whole story, it was shown to be wrong years and years ago, and yet it's still in the textbooks. This comes from a grade 7 school textbook, They're teaching this evolution of the horse. They're obviously learning it quite well. They've got quite good marks. And it's been known. This is lies. This is nonsense. And look what we're seeing in our textbook. We have skulls of... It says Australopithecus, and then it says Africa ain't man's. Australopithecus. Australopithecus ape. It is an ape. Nothing else. There are plenty of skulls of apes, but what's this Africa ape man's? It's nothing to do with an ape man, it's an ape. Pithecanthropus 4. Pithecus, ape, anthropus, man. Ape man. Now here we are looking at an ape man. And you see they show a skull, just like the ape skull above. You get the impression that you find skulls that you can look at. It's not true. You find little bits of skulls. You can see Pithecanthropus 4. That is one of the four ape men. There were those that went before it. One of them, it consisted of what they said was a perfect ape man's skull cap. It turned out to be an elephant's kneecap. One was not even a skull. It was said to be from an ape man's collarbone. It was found to be part of the dolphin's rib. They don't find nice ape men skulls. What they find is little bits of bone, and they put it together with plaster of Paris. Now this is one with a lot of bone. There are very few ape men which have as much bone as this. The bone is the dark part. The white is plaster of Paris, which is put together by the reconstructor. Now, there are very few with as much bone as this. This is a very famous ape man. It occupied the prime place in the British Museum for many years. More than 500 PhD theses were written on the position of this skull in the evolution of man from the apes. It was later discovered that the bone, which is dark because it was chemically stained to make it look old. The jawbone is actually from an orangutan. It had been doctored to make it fit, and the teeth had been filed. Most of them, of course, are plaster of Paris, but those which are not have been filed to make them look more like an ape man. So, what do we find? Forgeries. Why do people have to do forgeries? If there's real evidence, why do people not bring forward the real evidence? Now, very few are constructed from as much data as this. Most of them are constructed from one or two teeth and a few fragments here and there. This is a particularly famous one. It was reconstructed from one tooth. That's not uncommon. Peking Man, Alice Vale. This was given the impressive name Hesperopithecus. And it was given the name Hesperopithecus until an identical tooth to the one from which it was reconstructed was found. It was found to be part of a wild pig's jaw. The story about finding nice ape men skulls is just not true. You find a few little fragments and you put together a skull using imagination. And I just want to finish off with one of the pieces of evidence for evolution, which was particularly impressive when I studied biology at Wits in the very early 1970s. This is a page reproduced in our textbook. It's still being produced in textbooks today. And have you heard the story about humans having gill slits at one stage? Well, it comes from this set of drawings by Ernst Haeckel. They were produced more than 100 years ago and are still being reproduced now. You can see he starts off with a fish, a salamander, and then he goes right through to human being. And you can see they've all got these gill slits, all of them, right through to man. And look how similar they are. There's hardly any difference. And as the embryo goes on, it gradually gets more and more like what it eventually ends up as. what a wonderful proof of evolution. And we in the biology class looked at this and thought, my,
yes,
very good proof. But now, what happens if you look at photographs? You look at photographs of those things, now do you see exactly the same kind of similarity? And now let's just look at the top row we looked at. Here's his fish, and this is a real fish. Is there something you notice there? This fish doesn't have anything like gill slits, does it? Where did he get them from in his drawing? None of these things have got anything like gill slits. Like here, we've got in the human embryo three pouches which develop into the jaw and the ear. But gill slits? This story about gill slits, it is just plain lie. Nothing else but a lie. The whole story, nothing but lies. Well, we haven't time to look at anything else, so does anyone have any questions? Yes.
At the beginning, Dr. Stotz, you mentioned very prestigious publications. All right. Now, I can understand that people need recognition from their peer groups. I can understand doctorates, and I can understand professorships. Okay. But it would appear that evolution gets its sustenance and its power from men's arrogance, because doctors want to be recognised by their peers. Professors want to be recognised by their peers. Now, why is it not possible for Christian scientists to move completely out of that realm and get to the stage where they say, it doesn't matter if you're not published in this manuscript? If you've made an example, you're one of the finest archaeologists, I think it was, you said,
He
had a Master of Arts, but he was a fine geologist. Okay. The only reason doctors and professorships survive is because of the arrogance of that particular group of people wanting to be esteemed and recognized. Why can't the Christian fraternity move away from the secular acceptance of worship and move into the Christian world and say, okay, you want to believe that, get on, believe it. I understand also economics, you have to have a job. Why can't that be done? Why cannot not a Christian organization establish a standing, a recognition?
Okay, look, there are some very good Christians doing research, very valuable research, and publishing it in journals that are simply not recognised. But there's a problem. You cannot get government funding anywhere in the world for research that is not approved by the scientific establishment. Now, it's very difficult to do research without funding. So if you are going to get a job which the scientific establishment cannot throw you out of, you are going to have to do your science in your spare time. And that is happening. There are people doing this. But the rate at which you, as a group, a couple of hundred people, can make progress in your spare time, at your own expense, without the benefit of electron microscopes and anything like that, the rate you can make progress is tiny. And when you do make progress and you publish it in the journals like Ex Nihilo Technical Journal or CRSQ or even Galilean Electrodynamics, the number of people who read it is small, because the people who want to get on in science, they know they've got to stick within what's in the accredited journals. So it is going on, and I am convinced that in the not too distant future it will in fact take over, because science cannot continue except with a Christian worldview. For the very simple reason, it takes so much time, so much effort to make the slightest dent in the unknown, that you'll get nowhere by yourself. Each person doing some research can make a tiny little indent into the ignorance around us. And when lots of people work together, you can start to break into the ignorance and open up the light. Newton said, in his work, he was like a schoolboy who'd been standing by the sea of truth, the ocean of truth, and all he had been able to do was turn over two or three pebbles that were a little more attractive than the others, while all around him, everything remained undiscovered. Well, it's like that today. God's creation is so amazing, so complex, so profound, that a French professor of biology, a very famous professor, said, we mustn't deceive ourselves. If we studied the simplest bacterium forever, we would never find out everything about it. You know, we get the impression from the media that we know lots and lots of things. We know so little. What we know is dangerous. The things that the journals say, for example, about the genetic code, if you look what it said last year, and you look what it says this year, how can it be so different? They are struggling along in the dark, discovering a little bit here, and from a little bit they discover, they put together ideas, and they fabricate great stories, and they tell you these wonderful great stories, and then next year they've discovered something else, and that whole lot gets deflated, and now, well, we've got to build up some more big stories. What they have discovered so far is fantastic, it's amazing, but it's absolutely tiny compared to what needs to be discovered to actually understand it. So, to get anywhere, it requires a huge effort. Look at the vast number of researchers, the vast amount of money being put into trying to unravel the genetic code. And they're still way down at the bottom. There's all this to be discovered. And what they've found out, it's interesting, it's marvelous, but it's way down there. And that's when you've got all these people and all this money. How far do you think that some spare time Christian researchers are going to get? Not very far. But, you see, science cannot survive without a Christian worldview. Science started because Christians wanted to find out the truth about God's creation. Nowadays, you have people in science, it's a profession, and they want to get to the top. They want to become well-known professors with a big salary and a nice big retirement pension. And how do you do that? Well, you publish papers. And if it means being dishonest, if it means fabricating results so you can get more papers done, if you can do it by plagiarizing, why not? And this is being done. So the journals are full of things that are not true. Supposing you want to try and do some research based on what we saw there about the extreme scattering event structures. You'll waste 5 years doing some research and find out it doesn't work. You have to have an honest basis on which to begin your research. If you're building on lies, science cannot go anywhere. Science is coming to a dead end. Fred Hoyle, the chap who wrote this book about the intelligent universe, the one they wouldn't give the Nobel Prize to, he said science is in crisis. The best people are not coming into science. There are only second-rate people coming into science. And he says it's obvious why. we used to attract the best brains because they were searching for truth, and it was, there was a wonderful future in looking for the truth. Now, there is a future in conforming, getting papers published so that you can be recognized and become a professor. Science can't carry on like that. It can only carry on under the worldview, you shall not bear false witness. It's only Christianity has that.